The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com. I'm Tom Edwards, stepping in for Robert Bound on this week's edition of the Monocle Culture Show. Today, we're heading to the cinema for one of the summer's biggest blockbuster releases, Solo, A Star Wars Story. It was released just over a week ago and hasn't done as well as was expected at the box office. Plus, it's been met with a mixed response by the critics. The film was supposed to be directed by Chris Miller and Phil Lord, but they were taken off the project halfway through and replaced by Ron Howard. So, after a bumpy start, is this latest addition to the Star Wars franchise smooth sailing? Well, to find out, I'll be joined in the studio by film critic Karen Krasanovich and film critic for The Telegraph, Tim Robey. Han Solo, everyone's favourite intergalactic courier, was made famous by Harrison Ford, of course, and has now been taken on by the actor Alden Ehrenreich. Han is the pilot of the Millennium Falcon, of course, who, in previous Star Wars films, has been tasked with shipping and smuggling goods and people, along with his Wookiee co-pilot, Chewbacca. There he is. Han's ability to get himself into sticky situations has resulted in him treading a fine line between good and bad, but he's ultimately a hero of the franchise. So far in the series, he's saved the life of Luke Skywalker more than once, married Princess Leia, been a general in the Rebel Alliance, and he's even been frozen and used as an elaborate decoration in the house of oversized baddie Jabba the Hutt. In Solo, A Star Wars Story, we meet Han as a younger man and find out how he met Chewbacca and fellow smuggler Lando Calrissian as he becomes wrapped up in a heist that takes us into the criminal underbelly of the Star Wars films.
I was kicked out of the Flight Academy for having a mind of my own. I'm gonna be a pilot. Best in the galaxy.
Hey, kid. I'm putting together a crew. You in?
There he is again. Chewbacca, Tim and Karen, welcome to the programme. Chewbacca's not really here. Let's get our timeline straight, because we've had three Star Wars trilogies, I think. This is the second of two standalone spin-offs to the franchise so far. I guess, Karen, I'll start with you. So where does Solo, the film, fit into that sort of overall chronology?
Just to keep it simple, because I'm not totally a nerd on this. It's an origin story for Han Solo. And we wanted to know where he came from. Well, if you didn't want to know, you're going to find out anyway. And it's very much like a superhero origin story, Logan or Wolverine or, you know, whatever. We can't go forward in the timeline anymore in this story, but we love the characters and we love the world. So let's take it back. Let's do young Sherlock Holmes. So that's really where we are. And we're using a dude that looks a lot like the young Captain Kirk. A little bit.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Also, he looks a lot like Orson Welles. So he really looks like he should be on the screen. He's got that kind of a face. And also, this actor was discovered by Steven Spielberg at a bar mitzvah, which
I think is amazing. Great story.
Perfect. Yeah. So we're talking about origin stories all the way back.
And Tim, I gave a sort of rather broad description, I guess, of the film at the top. Plot-wise, I mean, Karen says it's an origin story. Is it one of those films where we need to worry too much about the plot? And if so, what's the key moment?
It's kind of a romp, or at least it was going to be kind of a romp. Because the thing about these prequels is that you can go off on a tangent and just have a bit of fun with them, really. Mm. And the thing that's a bit odd is that both these standalone films have ended up being a little bit more humorless than I think people were expecting. Rogue One was actually basically quite a gritty war movie with an extremely bleak ending. And this one, even though it was meant to be a kind of irreverent space operatic, origin story romp with the guys from the Lego movie attached to do it, they just decided clearly along the way that wasn't working, threw them out and brought in Ron Howard to kind of bring it in line. And he's such a safe pair of hands, he's almost deadeningly safe at times. He's being made to fit it all in quite neatly and quite sort of in quite a dry way, I think.
Well, Karen, on that point then, how far can you keep going before you just say, look, we don't need any more prequels because there's 10 or 12 movies and they're all over the place in the chronology anyway? Can't you just... Shouldn't they just be driving the story forwards? Or, I don't know, how do you strike that balance?
I don't think it's forward moving and linear at all now with franchises, as we've seen by all the superheroes. That it's more like taking a cup of syrup and pouring it out, and it's just spreading. It's going backwards, it's going forwards, it's going up. I think
it's spreading, but it's beginning to trickle off the table.
It is,
because
it is.
Commercially, like in China, for instance, every successive film has done much less well than the last one. Mm. This one has really bottomed out in China and other key markets for Star Wars. They've got to start taking a bit more time with them and being a little bit more selective about which ones to do, I think.
I think it's very difficult to do that. And I think what you said about Ron Howard is absolutely right. He's a safe pair of hands. He's been in the industry for years. And they needed somebody that was going to really, I mean, they needed a good pilot on this one to drive it through the very narrow cracks that this film was going to have to fly through. And when you have narrow cracks like that, you are basically risk averse because you've got so many, you've got new fans you want to attract and you've got old fans you want to retain. And you're going to lose both of them if you don't start stepping it up.
I like your pilot analogy because Ron Howard is not enough of a Han Solo Daredevil pilot. It's like Luke Skywalker making the movie.
Exactly.
He's the nice boy, you know. He's the hero, and the film is too heroic, really. And I think Han is not cynical enough. He's not edgy enough. He's not funny enough. He's not quite the same character that we're expecting to meet.
And it's funny, we keep talking about, you know, the audiences and their expectations, and there is this sort of weird pantheon of Star Wars. I mean, I'm very much generationally and interest-wise biased towards the original three, as I would term them. Is that part of the problem, perhaps, that people are treading almost too carefully, Karen? They want to sort of walk on eggshells because they know that, you know, Han is this sort of storied figure. He's kind of everyone's big brother, and that's the guy you pretended to be in the playground when you were a kid. Are they too worried about... Yeah, putting maybe a bit of menace or a bit of, you know, some rough edges.
I think that is certainly a concern because it has to be a family movie. But also, Harrison Ford's impossible to replace. Mm. He really is.
You realize the man was pretty good. He's pretty good.
A star for a reason, you know. And I love the fact that he was working as a carpenter, albeit a carpenter to the stars, before he hit it big. He fills the screen. You want to watch him. And this Han Solo, you want to watch him.
And I think you sense, because Alden Ehrenreich, a very good actor when he's on form, and fantastic in Hail Caesar, the Coen Brothers film, which was really the role that got him this one. But all the stories about him being a bit kind of sort of ill at ease on set and bringing on acting coaches and not quite feeling comfortable with the part, that translates to a performance which is just a little bit kind of dweeby and not quite confident and assertive enough. You can feel it. And so it's not really his fault, but he's just not quite there, you know.
I really wanted him to go full William Shatner in this. You know, I wanted him to just go and be a dick. Just go and be... Because we know that Han Solo has that in him. You know, that's where he walks that edge of being, a jerk. But he didn't quite do that. He was sort of a little matinee idol, a little Bollywood, a little held back.
And I think the effortless charisma of Donald Glover, who gets a good hour stretch in the film, just kind of eats him alive, really, whenever they're on screen together. It's Donald Glover you're watching more often.
And now he's very much sort of man of the moment, but is this a performance beyond just being in the right place at the right time? And it seems he maybe is tapped into that sort of missing Star Wars magic. Is that, in a sense, is that just, you know, the actors either have it or they don't, and it's not about the director or the budget or anything. It's just that little something, that extra facet.
It's really lucky alchemy, basically. He is the right man for the job at exactly the moment in his career when he's sort of cooler than he has been or probably will ever be. This is the year of Donald Glover.
Yeah.
And they've lucked in by casting him. And he does do a really clever but not too obvious Billy Dee Williams impersonation as well. So I really enjoyed all of his scenes. I really did not particularly like Emilia Clarke's character. She's the love interest, who's actually given a sort of potential for follow-ups, which is I found surprising. It's as if they're going to kind of push that character and her relationship with Han further forward into additional movies. Apparently there are some more coming, but this one is now underperforming, so will they scrap those? I don't know. I feel as though there are disturbances and ripples in the force here because of the film's underperformance commercially.
And what's the biggest risk, Karen? We talked a little bit, you know, they're big budgets, but they're churning them out pretty quick. They've got this very sort of aggressive timeline, which obviously keeps the marketers happy. Is that a risk that they sort of think, oh, well, we can sort of almost spend our way out of trouble?
I don't think any studio thinks that way anymore. I mean, they used to, but I don't think they can, particularly when surefire hits are tanking. And I think what's interesting is I heard down at Pinewood, in the art department particularly, they said, if you've held a pencil, they will suck you in for the next Star Wars movie. I mean, they are eating up all of the talent here in the UK, and probably bringing some in as well, in order to make these as visually dynamic as possible. And I think that that's where Ron Howard was perhaps not the best choice of director. Mm. We're used to something like Guardian of the Galaxy, or something where the camera is taking us on a trip. It's going places we didn't expect. And I'm not even talking about drones. I'm talking about basically post-production maneuvers. And he's shooting it sort of like kind of a very earthbound drama, which is not enough, particularly for these characters that are not exactly holding our attention that much. Granted, there were some moments of magic, for example, when L3 and Lando are sitting and they're about ready to take off and they do the little thing with their fingers. I still love that.
There are really nice touches, you're right. And of course, some of the material that the original director's shot would have made it into the finished film. We don't quite know which bits. But I think you're absolutely right about Guardians of the Galaxy. I think those films have slightly stolen the thunder off this one. And the idea of doing a kind of slightly camped up, irreverent space romp, we've had that now, and so it clearly wasn't quite working, and all of their improvisation was not quite panning out, so we've had to go very safe and very streamlined and very kind of predictable with it, really.
Basically, what's happened is the same thing happened to James Bond. James Bond was affected by Austin Powers and the Bourne franchise, and James Bond had to up its game, and now where is it going to go?
Well, we keep talking about this switcheroo between Phil Lord and Chris Miller and Ron Howard. Let's just talk a bit more about the specifics of that. Do we know, Tim, why Phil and Chris left, were taken off, were replaced? What was the sort of what's the public explanation for that being?
So it was more publicly kind of revealed than these instances usually are, because actually it's by no means the first time in Star Wars this has happened. You know, when Rogue One was slightly going astray, they brought in Tony Gilroy not only to rewrite the last act, but actually to shoot the whole of the last act. So even though Gareth Edwards is credited on that film, Tony Gilroy did direct quite a big chunk of it. And then subsequently they sacked Colin Trevorrow, who's the Jurassic World director, before production was even starting on Episode 9. They just decided Kathleen Kennedy, the uber creator of the whole saga at the moment in terms of production, decided he wasn't right for it. With Lord and Miller, what I gather is, I think what we were told is that they were just trying out too many comically kind of improvisation-y ideas, departing too much from the script. The screenwriter is Lawrence Kasdan, who's very unhappy about this, and he kind of complained. And I think between him and Kathleen Kennedy, they just decided this isn't right. Hmm. We need someone who's going to kind of respect the original script a bit more, so that in comes Ron Howard. Of course, this, again, many other examples in film history of directors being replaced. The one that strikes me as the kind of most extreme was when they made the prequel to The Exorcist, Exorcist the Beginning, back in 2005, originally directed by Paul Schrader, who shot the entire film, and it test screened so badly with the studio that they basically said, we're not going to release this. We're just going to reshoot the whole film with a different director. So they got Rennie Harlin. I mean, you can't really think of two directors further apart than Rennie Harlin and Paul Schrader to come in and redo the whole thing as a slightly more kind of fun multiplex version of The Exorcist rather than this dour religious drama. But then both versions were released. I mean, Schrader managed to get his film released as well. But they both came out and they were able to do a compare and contrast and kind of imagine how this was once one project. It was bizarre. But yeah, this happens, and sometimes the studios just do decide to throw good money after bad, as it were. In this instance, it hasn't really paid off because it would have been very expensive to do those reshoots, and they're not earning the money back now.
And Karen, I mean, Tim's already alluded to how frequently this does happen, whether it's credited, uncredited, and it's always been the way, and there's always been those little
little script maestros will come in, your sort of Bob Towns, I guess, who would just be like, oh, could you just sort this out for us? We're not quite sure. Why does it happen, though? Is it the execs haven't got their hand on the tiller? Is it expectation? Are people too fickle in reading even those sort of mid-shoot screenings and going, oh, look, everyone gasped when this did or didn't happen? Why does it happen and happen so much?
There's a lot of reasons why there are reshoots. It can be just somebody going, you know, I don't like that, somebody in power. Keep in mind that even Bicycle Thieves had, what, like 7 or 8 writers on it. You know, these films that we think walked out of the head of their director and writer. No, virtually every single film you see is going to have uncredited writers working on it somewhere. And then, of course, you've got the director and the editor working together. And then you've got post. So it's not exactly a pure thing issuing from a pair of people. Mm. It's a collaborative effort. So automatically, there's going to be a lot of variables. But primarily, it's because, I mean, it can be because of test audience. It can be that something's not clear. It can also be for something as banal as, well, actually quite important, as it's too long.
Yeah, it's usually nerves, and I think the length of the film makes executives very nervous. They always want to cut it down. They always want to get it shorter. We mentioned Magnificent Ambersons earlier. That's another very famous example. Orson Welles chose a very bad time to fly to South America, leaving the film in the hands of RKO, who just thought it was too long and too depressing. And they brought the editor in, Robert Wise, who basically hacked it down and reshot a completely different upbeat ending. Welles comes back and his film has been brutalized, and the original footage is nowhere to be found and is in fact permanently lost, which is terrible. So he didn't even get to do his Schrader, you know, his own version.
But at least they didn't hire Rennie Harlan. They hired Robert
they
Wise.
They didn't hire Rennie Harlan.
Robert Wise, who is like such a fantastic workman-like director.
He's more like the Ron Howard of his day, Robert Wise, I would say. Whereas I think Rennie Harlan's Magnificent Ambersons would be a real thing to see.
I mean, I would pay to watch that still, very much so. And what about what the... Well, it depends what side of this you're on, the wronged or righted person. It's interesting, you mentioned that the Schrader version did see the light of day. He's sort of taking another tilt at another thriller in this kind of area. Do directors sort of hold this sort of almost grudges and say, well, one day I'll make the film that I always wanted to make, this one be?
Yeah, I doubt he was very happy about the way it panned out, but at least Warner Brothers did give him a limited release for his version. They didn't just bury it, which in the days of, you know, MGM or whatever, the big studios, they would just bury any kind of slightly aborted version of the film would just never be allowed to see the light of day. Schrader got actually a shot there, and in fact he's made many worse films since Exorcist the Beginning. The Canyons, for instance, was one of the worst films ever made, but now he's got this comeback, First Reformed, with Ethan Hawke as a priest going through a crisis. I haven't seen it yet, but people say it's really interesting.
The trailer is amazing. Yeah. It looks really, really good. Of course, you know, we're not paying to watch the trailer. I know that. You know what really amazes me about the Star Wars, the Solo one, is that they hired Kasdan to write it. Kasdan and Howard, I mean, I mean, flashbacks to the 90s. You know, there's virtually...
Really 80s, actually.
You know,
yeah,
well,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Surely that must have been a discussion amongst the decision makers. Is that deliberate? Is that the play to say, look, you know, we want to sort of make something that maybe is a little nostalgic, that has a sort of American adventure, the history of Star Wars? Kasdan and Howard, you're almost there.
I think there is, you know, they're worried about the brand, first and foremost. We've worked very, very hard to maintain this. They wanted, you know, really safe people that they knew that were industry bods, no newcomers, no fresh faces. And also Kasdan has had, you know, a lot of writing. But then you see, if you look on his IMDb page, it's like, Star Wars, The Shadows of the Empire. Wait a minute, video game story. Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. Oh, he did the video screenplay for the director's cut. Now, wait a minute here. So he's kind of been hanging around kind of...
He knows the mythos. He knows what he's doing. But the thing is, they just made a mistake in having his script with Lord and Miller, because they were obviously clashing. Mm. Lord and Miller wanted to do a kind of crazy, surprising, spontaneous romp with loads of weird jokes that you would not expect. None of that would have been in the script, and just from word go on set, I think they probably wouldn't have been getting along.
It's very tempting, though, to think, I mean, everybody's fantasizing about, you know, what would it have been like if they'd been allowed to run free. It could have actually, if it had worked, started a whole new spurt of the franchise. But they're just not willing to risk the brand like that.
Especially after The Last Jedi, which was very divisive among the fans. A lot of the hardcore Star Wars fans really hated The Last Jedi. It's their worst ever. And so they were, that would have made them even more nervous about how Solo was going to be received. And they thought, oh, we're really in danger of driving them away forever unless we kind of bring this one in so it's sort of semi-entertaining. And I think it is semi-entertaining, I must admit. I didn't have a bad time with it. I don't think it has the dull stretches that Rogue One did for its first hour or so, where I found it really hard work. I thought they kind of kept it lively, and the casting is fun enough, and Donald's good, and it's always fun to see Woody Harrelson, even though he's done this role so many times before. And, you know, it's okay. But it's just like, are we at this level now where a kind of three-star Star Wars film is like, oh, well, that will do.
It could be. Yeah. And it's interesting, Karen, if we're talking again about reboots and also about another sort of storied, well, not really a franchise, but a film that was even longer in terms of the sequel, prequel, call it what you want, postquel. Sequel.
Sequel. That's we can stick with sequel.
Let's stick with the actual language.
And if you have a cold, NyQuil.
And you mentioned to us Blade Runner 2049, yeah. Of course. Now, this again, there's all sorts of mythology. There's Harrison Ford in there, who fell out with whom, and all the rest of it, and an even longer period. Are there connections in a way to be made between those two films, do you think?
The reason, no, there were several films when I was watching Solo. That room, I was thinking, oh, we've got some American Graffiti in there, and we've got some Back to the Future in there, you know, simply because there's a little bit of freshness leaking through. But really, it reminded me mostly of Blade Runner 2085. I blame or jet lag. That's my excuse. And I think it's because, okay, number one, the anticipation and the value attached to this and all of the stories and all of the pressure that this film had to be good. Are we, you know, and if it's not, it's going to wreck the previous one. I don't know how that works, but they worry about it. And the same thing is if we don't make Solo right, you know, something terrible happened to Harrison Ford. Maybe a garage door will fall on him or something. But I think the pressure of that, but also the fact that it needed to do certain things. It couldn't have just been, you know, innovative and just free. It had to tick boxes, you know. Had to have this, had to have that. And I think the same thing was happening with Solo. I'd love to have seen the list up on the wall, you know, maybe post-it notes about, you know, the things Solo had to have and Blade Runner, the things Blade Runner had to have in order to meet the criteria. It's like an identity criteria, you know, like it's not this unless it's this. For anybody who studies philosophy, you know what I'm talking about. So I just felt that while, and I loved the Blade Runner postquel, we'll call it that, but I didn't find it yummy. You know, I wasn't sitting in the cinema awake. I was occasionally looking at my watch. but some of the visuals were amazing. And I felt the same way in Solo. I thought, you know, I should watch this. And I did enjoy some of it. But there were moments when I thought it really needed more fizz.
You mentioned young Sherlock Holmes finally earlier, which I think is an interesting parallel to this because Barry Levinson directed young Sherlock Holmes. But that was in the mid-80s when he's kind of a young guy and he's like, we can do a spirited, lively reinvention of the Holmes mythos and kind of keep it really light on its feet. That film is really fun, actually, and I think there's a certain kind of nostalgia for it. Solo is just, it's just a bit more solid and it's solid. You know, it hits the marks, as you say. It kind of ticks the boxes, but it's not really spirited in the way that you want it to be.
Is there something of a, I guess it's kind of paradoxical almost, which is that to be innovative, and you mentioned that word, Karen, in the context of Blade Runner 2049, but to be really innovative and to sort of make the mark that the original that everyone has this nostalgia around is, you kind of need to take a punt. You need to get these young Tyros together, do something really speculative, and we've already discussed it to the nth degree. The money means that you can't do that. I mean, are we trapped in that reality when it comes to this sort of project, Tim?
Yeah, it does feel like a producer's franchise still, and the baton has sort of been passed to Kathleen Kennedy instead of George Lucas having total control over everything. But it is a bit like with the Bond series where, you know, they've rarely taken huge risks with directors. They've usually found kind of B-list directors who will do what they're told, and then you get a really great second, you know, assistant director in to do the stunt work or whatever. You have your Vic Armstrong, and you can sort of take over a bit in the edit, and the director doesn't really get to stamp his vision on it that much. And then you sort of pretend that Sam Mendes is stamping his vision on it. But in fact, they hired Stuart Baird, who's an action specialist, to do the editing on Skyfall to kind of make it faster and more fun. So there's always these other people in play, and it's not really a director's prerogative to kind of take over and have complete say over it. I mean, J.J. Abrams did very well, I think, to kind of hang on Force Awakens, and he's coming back, isn't he? He's clearly the one they trust the most.
Mm-hmm. So if it's, do you need to go for new franchises to showcase the new talent? Because we have seen it a little with the Star Trek thing. They were willing to kind of seemingly push the envelope a bit. What do you think, Karen?
Well, that's not going to happen unless they get to a point. We see they're making their errors as they go along. Mm. They're gonna find a level of risk that they're gonna be comfortable with. I mean, for example, the $6 billion man just folded at Pinewood, lost its director, Damien Cifron, who was the Argentinian that did Wild Tales. Now, he was also writing it. That was going to be a really exciting film. But rumor has it that Mark Wahlberg, there was some sort of difficulty there, and they all think he's going to team up with Peter Berg. So it's about who you get along with, and who makes the creative decisions and who carries them out. Often, if you're seeing a movie, you really don't have any idea if what you like is what the director did. Mm. I mean, it could be editor, could be producer, could be, anybody. So in order to try and fix credit or blame, it's actually quite difficult. So I think when it comes to, I would love to see something risky. I mean, I'd love to say like Get Out is risky, but a lot of people are going, ooh, it's so derivative. But I love to see risk, except when it doesn't work.
Well, Get Out was like a $5 million film, yeah. So it wasn't considered a big risk. It just was a great little roll of the dice that paid off beautifully and had a lot of good ideas in it.
And Tim, just to maybe wrap up particularly, we've been talking a lot about this point actually that Karen just made about, whose film are you watching? Are there still people where, we talk about, the auteur generation, even though, again, even in these films that we think are instant classics, they probably had quite a troubled origin story themselves. I guess two things. One, are there those filmmakers who are, you're getting their vision? And two, does it matter if you're not as a viewer?
I would say almost the only filmmaker, Denis Villeneuve is edging in that direction, but he Blade Runner didn't actually make a lot of money. But the only filmmaker who really belongs in that tradition of the kind of the Kubrick deal, where Kubrick and Warner Brothers just would always make their films together and they would trust him to deliver a film that they would be able to market and sell successfully, is Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan is the one at the moment, in fact. Even someone like Spielberg is sort of dabbling in different projects here and there with mixed success. Nolan, when a Nolan film comes along, it's always going to be a big deal. It's almost always Warner Brothers. It's always on a very huge scale and big budget, and you kind of know what you're going to get from it. He is almost the closest thing to a blockbuster auteur that we still have, I think, for better and worse. I mean, a lot of those filmmakers lost their chance to do that in the late 70s, obviously, when films like Heaven's Gate came along, which were crushingly expensive and destroyed studios. And it's really that did change the way the business operates. Mm. James Cameron, of course, he's still out there, and we'll wait to see what happens with Avatar 2.
He can actually make something popular, whereas Christopher Nolan is seen a bit sort of like expensive art house.
But his films make so much money. His films like $800 or $900 million, and that he reinvented the Batman saga, and Inception made a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's true. But there also is, I think, a risk of people finding it, a bit po-faced and a bit, there's not enough. I can't crunch popcorn to this film. I think one thing to keep in mind that there are filmmakers that also work in tandem with editors, for example, Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker, etc. I mean, there are teams that work together.
Oh, yeah, and when you bring Spike on a Lee Sam Mendes or whatever, the best move he made was to hire Roger Deakins to shoot the Bond films, and they suddenly look so much better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
right.
Hoyte van Hoytema on the next one as well. He knows how to get good crew around him to kind of make the films look good at least.
So on that Bond front, it's Danny Boyle is obviously going to do one. So what does that mean? Do we say this is identifiably a Danny Boyle picture from the get-go, or will it be more of the same-ish?
Well, we know that John Hodge is doing the script, which I think is good news, because I think they've relied on the same guys to do the scripts for the last few years, and I feel as though the scripts have been really quite weak on the Craig Bonds, and the quips have been so bad, the kind of jokes have been so
it's the bad
feeble.
Bad quips is why I go and
but
watch the Bond
Roger
movies.
Moore can sell a bad quip. Daniel Craig can't,
because Daniel Craig isn't wearing a leisure suit
and he just has no sense of humour. So when he comes out of a lake and says I got in some deep water, Roger Moore would make that funny.
Bowl Bang on Time is my favourite, or whatever. There's so many. He had a rather inflated opinion of himself.
Yes, exactly.
Classic.
Yeah.
Who would be the fantasy directorial appointment then to do the next Star Wars thing? If suddenly Karen was in charge, you can parachute them in and they have full creative control.
I've got one.
Tim,
go on. Catherine Bigelow. I think Catherine Bigelow would be really good.
Ooh, for Star Wars.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
Why not Jordan Peele? Why not?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to see something. I just shake me up. Do something, you know, make some big mistakes, but also thrill me.
There you go. We can't. That's the call to action right there to end the program. That brings us to the end of the Monocle Culture Show. Solo, A Star Wars Story is out in cinemas around the world right now. Thanks to my guests today, Karen Krasanovich and Tim Roby. Thanks too to my producer, Holly Fisher, and our special Star Wars advisor, Bill Luty. I don't know what's involved with that, but it sounds very professional. Robert Bound will be back at the same time next week with another review. But until then, from me, Tom Edwards, thanks for listening.